Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Monday, June 12, 2017. Former Alabama Senator, now U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, will testify before an open session of the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow. He will face fresh questions about his role in firing former FBI Director James Comey. Sessions, a key campaign advisor to Donald Trump and the first senator to endorse him, stepped aside from the investigation into Russian involvement in the 2016 presidential campaign back in early March. This after he acknowledged he lied. He said under oath at his January confirmation hearing that he had not met with Russians during the campaign, but he eventually acknowledged that he had spoken twice in the months before the election with the Russian ambassador to the U.S., and there was a possible third meeting, which is under investigation. Lawmakers, including Al Franken of Minnesota and Patrick Leahy of Vermont, have asked the FBI to investigate and determine if Sessions committed perjury. Meanwhile, Jeff Sessions can expect questions about his involvement in Comey's May 9th firing, the circumstances surrounding his decision, and whether any of his decisions, such as interviewing FBI director candidates or meetings with Trump about Comey, violated his recusal pledge. The Justice Department today said it requested an open meeting so American people can hear the truth directly from Sessions. The hearing will bring sharp questioning for Sessions and likely some uncomfortable moments from the Trump administration. Eyes will be on Donald Trump's Twitter. In other news, there are a number of cases pending against Donald Trump for violations of the Constitution of the United States. Today, the Attorneys General of Maryland and the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit in federal court against Trump. It alleges that he flagrantly violated the emoluments clauses of the Constitution, which explicitly bars presidents from receiving gifts or inducements from foreign or domestic entities. District of Columbia Attorney General Carl Racine.
Never in the history of this country have we had a president with these kinds of extensive business entanglements, or a president who refused to adequately distance themselves from their holdings. President Trump's businesses and his dealings violate the Constitution's anti-corruption provisions, known as the emoluments clauses. The framers included these two anti-corruption provisions to prevent foreign and domestic entities from seeking to influence the president by bestowing money or other things of value on him. Why did the framers include these clauses? It was all about corruption. As Alexander Hamilton wrote, one of the weak sides of republics, among their numerous advantages, is that they afford too easy an inlet to foreign corruption. The framers knew that government entities, foreign and domestic, would of course try to use things of value to influence or induce the president to do their bidding instead of that of the American people. And now we see it every day. My office window is just a few floors above where we're sitting today, and I can tell you that as I look out the window and see the tower of the Trump International Hotel, we know exactly what's going on every single day. We know that foreign governments are spending money there in order to curry favor with the President of the United States. Just one example, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, whose government has important business and policy before the President of the United States, has already spent hundreds of thousands of dollars at the Trump International Hotel.
Racine says that hotel is only one example of how Trump's vast global businesses are entangled with foreign and state government interests. He says we are a nation of laws and no one is above the law. The danger, says Racine, is that Trump is eroding our democracy and our faith in our democratic institutions. General Racine says just when they are needed the most, traditional checks and balances are failing.
First, by not divesting from his businesses, the president has chosen to put himself and our country in the situation we find ourselves today. And every time the president has spoken about drawing a line between his presidency and his businesses, he's walked his promises back. Second, the Republican-controlled Congress has wholly failed to fulfill its responsibility of serving as a check and balance on the president, and has thus far given the president a total pass on his business entanglements. State attorney generals answer to the people of their jurisdictions, and we have a duty to enforce the law, and that's why we're taking action today. Like the unfairly maligned press corps and the courts, state attorney generals are serving as a necessary check and balance in the Trump era where others fail. We are the officials who brought the lawsuits that stopped President Trump's unconstitutional and un-American Muslim travel ban. We also call on the Department of Justice to appoint a special prosecutor in the Russia investigation.
The attorneys general from D.C. and from Maryland stood alongside posters with definitions of the emoluments clauses of the Constitution. There's the clause which states that presidents are prohibited from accepting any emoluments, any gifts or presents or other form of profit or gain from any king, prince, or foreign state. But there's also a domestic emoluments clause which prohibits any president from receiving any other emolument from within the United States on top of his salary. Maryland's Attorney General Brian Frosch says the case brought forth is about the right of millions of Americans to honest government. He says it puts democracy at risk when the president is corruptible, that the president must have only the interest of the American people at the heart of every decision. But he says that's not the case with Trump.
Our constituents must know that a president who orders their sons and daughters into harm's way is not acting out of concern for his own business. They must know that we will not enter into a treaty with another nation because the president owns a golf course there. They must know that we will not change our trade policy because a foreign government patronizes the president's hotels or resorts, and that the president will not favor one state over another with millions of dollars of federal money because one state has given his business a tax break. Never in our history has a president maintained a domestic and international business empire where his personal interests are tangled up with the policy interests of our country, or where those personal interests could affect decisions about every aspect of American life, from national security to public health, from protection of consumers to protection of natural resources. It's unprecedented that the American people must question day after day whether decisions are made and actions are taken to benefit the United States or to benefit Donald Trump. The framers of the Constitution understood these dangers, and that's why they wrote the emoluments clauses. That's why they made clear that the president cannot accept a foreign emolument of any kind, whatever. They anticipated the corrosive dangers of even the appearance of compromised government.
The Attorney General of Maryland says Trump's conflict of interest threaten our democracy, that we can't normalize Donald Trump's behavior, can't allow the constant barrage of questionable activities to make us numb.
Here's a little about what we know so far about what the president has done. He's pitched the Trump International Hotel to foreign diplomats and to government officials. He appears frequently at Trump establishments, using his role as president as a marketing device to raise their public profile. He's paid by companies owned by foreign governments, including China, which leased space at Trump Tower. He continues to take money from foreign governments, including Saudi Arabia, India, Afghanistan, and Qatar, who own property in Trump World Tower, and pay him charges associated with those properties. He doubled the fees at Mar-a-Lago after he was elected from $100,000 to $200,000. He hosts foreign leaders there, using the trappings of the presidency to heighten its profile. He even promoted his resort on a State Department website and on embassy websites. He's pursued trademark protection in China for 10 years. He was unsuccessful the entire time. During his campaign and after his election, he indicated he might end the One China policy. But on February 9th, he met with the president of China, pledged to continue the One China policy. 5 days later, China gave him trademark protection. He doesn't appear to understand or care about these violations of the Constitution that he swore to uphold and protect. He flouts them. He brags about them, and as we now know from his tweets, he has little respect for the rule of law, and he has little respect for the court's ability to enforce the law. We do not sue the President of the United States casually. I wish President Trump had addressed these issues, these violations, himself, but he has not, and they must be addressed and remedied.
The Maryland and D.C. attorneys general are seeking a full disclosure of Trump's financial information, including his tax returns. Procedurally, Trump has 60 days to respond to the complaint. Another focus of the lawsuit is on the fact that Trump chose to retain ownership of his company when he became president. Trump said he was shifting assets into a trust managed by his sons to eliminate potential conflicts of interest. But D.C. Attorney General Racine says what many have said before, that what Trump says can't be relied on.
The American public knows that the president sometimes says things he doesn't mean. And the president, in regards to separating from his businesses, has said a lot. For example, he indicated that he would not receive any briefings on his businesses from his sons. Well, that was quickly changed, that his sons are now acknowledging that they're giving regular briefings to the president.
Donald Trump and his attorneys argue that the emoluments clauses don't cover fair value transactions, such as hotel room payments and real estate sales. So far, the emoluments clauses have not been tested by federal circuit courts or the Supreme Court, but cases are pending. The House and the Senate Democrats plan to sue Donald Trump over what they believe is an ongoing violation of the Constitution's emoluments clauses. And a lawsuit is still pending, which was filed in the Southern District of New York by the government watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has been looking into the Trump Organization, as well as potential harms to taxpayers in relation to the emoluments clause. In other news, lawyers for Hawaii tell the Supreme Court that letting the Trump administration enforce a ban on travel from six mostly Muslim countries would thrust the country back into the chaos and confusion that resulted when the policy was first announced in January. The state urged the justices today to deny an administration plea to reinstate the policy after lower courts blocked it. The High Court is considering the administration's request and could act before the justices wind up their work at the end of June. The state says the policy is unconstitutional because it shows anti-Muslim bias. Hawaii points to comments Trump made last week on Twitter to underscore its arguments that the policy is a thinly veiled Muslim ban. Trump tweeted on June 5th, "That's right, we need a travel ban in caps for certain, in caps, dangerous countries, not some politically correct term that won't help us protect our people." Meanwhile, another U.S. Court of Appeals is continuing to block Trump's travel ban. The court is the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Seattle. They have upheld a decision blocking Trump's revised travel ban. The judges say the president violated U.S. immigration law by discriminating against people based on their nationality, and that Trump failed to show their entry into the country would hurt American interests. They didn't rule on whether the travel ban violated the Constitution's ban on the government officially favoring or disfavoring any religion. The 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia also ruled against the travel ban on May 25th. The administration has appealed that ruling to the Supreme Court. Donald Trump has been railing against the Justice Department for not standing behind his initial travel ban and instead reissuing a watered-down version. Meanwhile, Trump's ban and an increase in activity by ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, has been scaring documented and undocumented Americans. Data provided by ICE shows that immigration arrests are up nearly 40% since Trump signed that executive order on immigration enforcement back in January. Half of those arrested have no criminal record, and this is taking its toll on New York City students, where nearly half are from immigrant households. Matt Patterson has the story.
New York public school teachers, many immigrants themselves, have been trying to calm the fears of students who worry about their parents and other family members being deported. Some share their own immigrant experience to help reassure their classes. A group of those teachers and their students came together at the 2017 Left Forum in New York City for a panel called Documented, Undocumented: Stories by Immigrant Youth.
Myself and Dr. Alan Singh and some of my former students, we think that being, you know, the issue of immigration is an important one.
Pablo Muriel is a New York City public school teacher at the Alfred E. Smith School in the South Bronx.
We put a panel together, and we first presented at the New York City Museum about a month ago, and we decided to also present at the Left Forum because it's an issue that I feel that it isn't gaining as much attention as it should. Immigration, unless you understand the issue, or unless you're dealing with it yourself or a close family member, it's almost a non-issue for most people who don't have contact with immigrants.
So I was an illegal immigrant for about 18 years.
Feruza Uddin teaches global history at a high school in Queens. She came to the U.S. as a child.
I've lived in America all my life. My mom brought me here when I was 2 years old. Grew up in an immigrant community in Astoria, Queens. I assimilated to the American culture very well. I didn't really have any identity crisis whatsoever. I mean, throughout my life, I thought that I knew that I wasn't able to leave the country. And I remember always envying my friends who would leave the country and come back and, you know, bring in gifts from their grandparents and their relatives. And I never had that opportunity. But I've always kind of just put in the back of my mind thinking like, oh, eventually it's going to happen. It wasn't until I was in high school, when I was in 11th grade, and all my friends were applying for jobs. And I wanted to apply just like them, you know, and work and have my own set of money. And once I tried to apply, there was a small box that asked for my social security number. It was a foreign number to me. I didn't even know what that was. So I asked my mom, like, hey, mom, what's my social security number? And it was right then and there that I realized that, I'm an undocumented immigrant, and my situation, it's a lot more serious than I've thought it would ever be.
Her story of not knowing she was undocumented is common in the immigrant community. Feruza says her experience gaining legal status helps her advise her students.
I am a global history teacher at a high school in Queens. The school is predominantly a South Asian populated school. A lot of my kids are first generation immigrants. I remember this past January when the current administration passed the whole Muslim immigration ban, a bunch of my students came up to me and literally asked, Miss, my mom and dad, one particular kid actually told me how her mom left to Bangladesh for a month and she's a green card holder. Will she come back? Now, Bangladesh may not be on the 7 banned list that Trump did, but it was a real fear for my kids. Even the day after the election, I had kids telling me, Miss, my hands are trembling when I found out he won. I don't know what's going to happen to my family. So, I mean, the fear is real, and because I've experienced this uncertainty for 18 years, I was able to have that empathy for my kids.
Immigrants often worry about their status and about whether they would get back into the United States if they leave. This was the case with Evelyn Acosta. She is now a bilingual special ed teacher.
I lived with my grandma when I was in Colombia. My grandmother was diagnosed with cancer, fourth stage, so I was forced to be brought here by my mother, who was already here, and that's how I ended up here at 8. At the beginning, it was very shocking, obviously. I mean, I'm a Colombian child in a whole new world. But I would say after a few years, I became more American than I was Colombian. And as time passed by, I was more and more American. So I kind of lost a lot of touch with my Colombian side. As soon as I received my resident status, you had to be given 3 years prior before you became a citizen, and I didn't wait since I lived in fear for the majority of my life. As soon as the 3 years came up, I became a citizen then.
With our school system serving more and more immigrant families and increasing pressure from the Trump administration, the work of these teachers will continue to be essential for years to come. Pablo says they're in the business of providing hope to their students.
If it isn't hopeful, why come to school? You know, so one of the main issues that I constantly, when I talk about immigration, is how are you going to deal with this? You know, how are we going to do this together? What are your, first of all, let's find out what are your rights as a human being here in the United States? And secondly, what are your rights as an undocumented immigrant? Let's find those things first. And obviously, I got to bring it back to the curriculum. So, like, I have this, one of my units on immigration as a U.S. history teacher, I have a worksheet where it was by a commissioner, Binghamton, in 1910. I erased the date and all of the races, and I give it to them, and it says, well, these people are thieves, they're pickpockets, they're robbers, you know, we need to get rid of them. And so the kids start putting down, oh, you're talking about Mexican, Puerto Rican, Dominican, black people, you know. And then I give them the original one, let them read it, and then the original one says Jewish, Italian, Irish. And the kids, they're in disbelief. Who would do that? I said, well, it was written in 1910, and that was the immigrant group at the time. So this is what they dealt with. So it's almost to not make them feel like it's something wrong with you. No, there's really something wrong with our system that so many people have to go through this sort of, you know, baptism by fire just to become, to enjoy the benefits of being an American, in essence, a human being, you know.
It's telling that one of the students meant to speak on Saturday had to cancel at the last minute because his parents were having an urgent immigration issue. To find out more about immigrant organizing in New York City, go to the New York Immigration Coalition at thenyic.org.
Matt Patterson reporting. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. The Puerto Rican Day Parade was a huge success, according to many of those who marched in it, despite right-wing and elite efforts, which resulted in corporate sponsors pulling their support over revolutionary hero Oscar Lopez being honored. But Oscar Lopez Rivera did ride on a lead float, and New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark-Viverito at one point climbed up on that float with him, honoring him as the Puerto Rican independence hero that he is. She said this is a day of unity and celebration. Supporters followed with signs saying, "Oscar Lopez is our Mandela." The parade was held on the same day as Islanders were voting on a referendum among three choices: independence, statehood, or their current territorial status. Nearly 500,000 votes were cast for statehood, about 7,600 for free association, independence, and nearly 6,700 for independence. Congress has the final say on any changes to the territory's political status. Ana Lopez is a professor at Hostos Community College. She teaches Latin American and Caribbean American studies. She was part of the campaign to free Oscar.
We are experiencing incredible joy, and the last 4 days we've been celebrating the victory of his release. President Obama commuted his sentence on January 17 with 3 months of house arrest, and he was released on May 17 with no conditions. So he's been able to travel, and everywhere he goes there's been big celebrations. It's seldom that we have victories, so this is a great victory for all of us. So much that the Puerto Rican parade this year had a special title for Oscar in the parade, honoring him with the title of Freedom Hero. And that has ruffled a lot of feathers, people who were opposed to the board making that type of decision, which has caused many of the sponsors of the parade, the huge corporations like Goya, Coca-Cola, JetBlue, AT&T, they pulled out their contributions to the parade because they didn't believe that the parade had a right to name someone like Oscar a freedom hero. And it's been very interesting. The parade took a stand and said, corporations, you don't tell us what to do. You don't make decisions for us. And I think this has been a part and parcel of our decolonization process. We've been a colony for 117 years. The first decolonization process where we felt this joy and celebration was when the Puerto Rican people kicked out the Navy out of Vieques, their island municipality. The U.S. Navy was kicked out. And in 1999, we launched a campaign to free 14 political prisoners. And now Oscar's release this year, it's an added part of our decolonization process. In particular, also the board of the parade taking that position and standing strong in what they believe in is also the process of decolonization. So we're not there yet completely, but we are definitely empowering our communities to make the right decision, to not allow corporate America to dictate to us what decisions we make. And today we had a huge contingent for Oscar with the floats and music, and it was over 1,000 people marched to celebrate Oscar's release in spite of everyone else who didn't like that idea. So, and I think that there was a lot of positive reaction, and there was, the people were very pleased that we were there and doing this.
Lopez said it was the Puerto Rican Statehood Party who opposed Oscar Lopez being honored.
An elite of the Statehood Party in Puerto Rico, they want statehood for Puerto Rico, in conjunction with the FBI, prepared a campaign of smear against Oscar. And so when he was coming to New York, they launched that campaign. It's going to be short-lived because it's not based on the grassroots. It's all at the elite level, so there's no real mass support for their position. But it was propagated, well-intentioned, not well-intentioned, bad-intentioned press propaganda against Oscar. And it has not changed the people's opinion about him. In fact, we had a huge event at Hostos, and it was amazing the level of spirit and love that was manifested towards Oscar. And all the four events have been, the number of people that have turned out have been enormous. So I don't think that this media smear campaign has been able to really change how people feel about Oscar. He continues to be our national hero. And my message to those corporations are, you do not dictate who we are, how we see the vision for our country. And Oscar is a great example of how do you maintain steadfast, strong, you love your country, you fight for your country, and you persevere. And this, and Oscar represents freedom. So I think that that's the avenue that we are taking at this moment.
Hostos Community College professor Anna Lopez. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Monday, June 12, 2017. The news was produced with Matt Patterson, Akin Killick, Stan Waldika, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
La llena.